Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Mum and Mama podcast, brought to you as always by the lovely Golding Accountancy. We are golding.com. How are you? I hope you are good. This week, the lovely Marcus Birdman joined me to talk to me all about life as a stand-up comedian, how he got where he is, and also the fact that he's had a couple of strokes and he's very young to be having strokes, but how that's affected him and his comedy, really. But yeah, I hope you enjoy it, and I'll see you in a bit.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Work. I'm recording also, so we're good. Hello.
Hello. I have both of my daughters at home.
Yeah.
Because the school isn't shut, but they kind of said you don't need to send the kids in if you don't want to.
Yes.
So I was like, there's no way in the world I can send them in. And they get there and then they realise that they didn't have to be there.
Yeah, no, you'll be for it.
Yeah, they're at home. But they're looking after the dog, the puppy, so...
Nice. How old are your kids? What, they're girls?
8 and 11, yeah. Yes. So, my eldest one, we got all her new school uniform.
Oh, nice.
Because she started senior school in September.
Yeah.
So, my bed behind the computer is just covered in all her new school uniform stuff that she's...
Got it.
And her shirts are Velcro. Have you ever heard of Velcro shirts?
What do you mean, like that? They're Velcro done.
So they have buttons.
Yeah.
So they look like normal shirts, but she can. I was a bit like, I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah.
I mean, but I think it's for PE reasons.
Rather than loosing their bosom to some undeserving boy. Is that what you mean?
I know. I was a bit like, I don't. I didn't. I mean, I don't know. I just felt. I can understand, obviously it makes things a bit quicker.
Yeah.
But, and then it also seems like, but that's part of it, isn't it, doing up your shirt?
Learning to do that. I don't know. I think maybe you're overthinking it with respect, I think, Amy. I think there's lots of different tops you can wear. I mean, I think as long as she knows how to do buttons. I think one has a tendency to kind of catastrophize everything when you're a parent. And so you sort of think, you know, if I said that to you, you want to say hello to my dog, by the way?
Yes, please.
Decided to sit on my, come on then, George, come up here. Come on, say hello. There we are.
Oh, hello.
Say hello. No, rubbish.
Hello.
I think when someone else tells you something about what their child might have done or not have done, and you go, sounds all right, and... But when it happens to your own child, you think, well, it's like today it's smoking, but tomorrow it's crack kind of thing, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So today Velcro, tomorrow she's a stripper. Yeah, yeah. I think you're probably not.
I think because she told me I took the dog out early this morning because obviously it's like the hottest day in the world ever. And she told me when I was on the phone to her and I was over the park. And as soon as I got off the phone, I was like, I had to tell someone because it really, I don't know, I felt really weird about it. But it's such a stupid thing to
I've got a, it's a bit of a pain in the ass because I've got like a boiler suit that's Velcro up the front and you can never match it up. Do you know what I mean? It's always like you've. It's a bit sort of, I don't know what the right word is, but not right.
I understand.
She's probably better off with buttons. Can she have button shirts, presumably?
Well, yeah, she can, but I'll just need to send... I don't know why I've got these shirts. I just was ordering everything the other day online.
And that's what
I was
came.
Just like, right, you need shirts, you need this, you need that, you know. But they've turned up and they're Velcro. Mm. But I think I just need to get over it.
Yeah, I mean, I think
she's
there's...
happy about it. And I was like, fine.
That's your definition of a first world problem, isn't it? I think right there. Okay, George, I'm going to put you down. That's because you're hot. Someone was having a cock. Have you got dogs? My cockapoo is delightful, but that is like wearing a sheepskin coat on top of me, on as you pointed out correctly, the hottest day of the year. He's gone.
So now I've got a dog. I've never had a dog before. Mm. And now I have a dog. I've met all these people with all these dogs. And it's really lovely. It's social.
What have you got? Sorry, excuse me.
She's a rescue.
Oh, right.
From Greece. So she looks like a retriever, like a golden retriever. But her face is a bit more pointy. So I think she's got shepherd in her.
Nice.
But her fur's a bit like a husky. Yeah. So she's like a mountainy kind of dog.
Right.
Weirdly, my friend she's got dogs, and she was walking her dog this morning in Chapel Heath, and the exact same dog was in Chapel Heath, but she was trying to ask the guy where he'd got her from, but he couldn't really understand what she was trying to say. She said that she thought that he might have been Greek.
Oh, right.
So maybe it's just a Greek dog.
Why? I didn't realise that was the sort of thing, that you had to go to Greece to get your rescue dog. I mean, there were enough here, is that right, or...?
No, there are. It's hard to get. You can't really get puppies here. And the only reason I really wanted a puppy was because I've got a cat.
Mm.
And I thought the younger the dog is, the more likely it is to like the cat.
That would make sense, I suppose.
That was the thinking behind it anyway.
Yeah.
And also, it's hard when I've got children. If they're under a certain age, it's hard to get a dog here.
Yes.
I think they prefer you to either be experienced or have older children, so there's kind of less of a risk.
I see, yeah.
And I did want a rescue, but my friend adopted a dog from Russia, and she was like, oh, you should look at this website. And then, of course, you find all these other websites, and it's just all pictures of these beautiful puppies all the time. And I had decided against it because I was like, I have enough going on in my life. The last thing I need to do is get a puppy. But then I was sitting in the garden, it must have been a couple of months ago now, and just this little face popped up on my phone, and I was just like, oh.
Well, I need that in my
and
life.
Before I knew it, that was it.
Yeah, good, good. Nice, though, really nice. George is maybe... He's coming up to 6 years old, actually, and he's just really great. But having been fairly resistant, it's actually my daughter doesn't live with me, but she lives just down the road. She's about a mile away with her mum, and comes to me originally when, well, I mean, we split up 10 years ago, and originally she lived with me half the week. And so, okay. And then that sort of morphed into living with her mum sort of full time, but coming to visit me half the week. And so, because she's an only child, we thought a dog would be a good of surrogate sibling. So technically,
does the dog stay with you?
Well, technically, it's her dog, so it's supposed to shadow her. But Kana, yeah, which is fine. I mean, like, especially during lockdown, was brilliant. I mean, if I'm on the road, I can't. Well, sometimes I take George. If I know, like, for instance, this week I'm going to Bristol and Bath, and my mum lives down there, so I'll be able to take him. And certain gigs, if I know that there's a decent backstage or whatnot, I can take the dog. But others, a bit more tricky, really.
So is that where you're from originally?
No, I'm originally from, well, originally, I'm from the northeast. That's where my dad was, and my siblings and I were all born. But we all moved down to Bishop Stortford. So we're sort of like, which is, you know, half Essex and half Hertfordshire. So this isn't where I'm from originally, but my dad was really into sailing, and we'd come down here quite a lot to Lee. He had mates who had boats here, and I guess it was probably the nearest place to come and sail, at least in the sea. So I was quite familiar with Lee, but yeah, I'm not originally from here.
How did you get into comedy?
There's not a short answer to this, but the slightly short long answer is I was in bands, which I did backing singing. I don't have a particularly good singing voice.
Okay.
But I always wrote the lyrics, and I was always very interested in writing poetry and lyrics and prose and whatnot. And then got into kind of maybe writing, as I say, lyrics, then writing poetry, and then got into performance poetry. And then from performance poetry, my daughter Clementine's mum, her best friend, if you can follow that evolution, was a comedy producer, and she saw me do performance poetry, saying you should do stand up. And at that point, I was like, no, you know, no way, that's too scary and all of this sort of business. So, and then she entered me into a competition, like a new act competition, and I kind of thought, well, I don't want to be a bottler. I'll do it. It'll be a car crash, but I'll still do it anyway. And then I ended up doing actually all right and got into the final, which went to Edinburgh. And there I met kind of comics who I liked the cut of their jib. I think I'd previously thought it was a bit maybe alpha and a bit kind of mainstream and a bit like sort of bald blokes talking about their, you know, wives and mother-in-laws type thing. And I hadn't really, and then I'm, which there is definitely a contingent to that. But when I was in Edinburgh, I found that there was a lot of comics who were quite left field and arty and kind of come from, you know, I went to art college and that's my background. And so I felt
what
a sort
did
of
you do?
Fine art.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I suppose I was always like, as the great Ian Dury said, I'm not working class, I'm arts and crafts. So I sort of been in that world, you know. But met comics who were similarly in that world, but were comedians, and I kind of realised, oh, that's sort of possible. There's a sort of arty element to this as well.
Yeah.
I use arty liberally in that sense. And they were making a living. You know, I was kind of like, because I was at, you know, I was at art college trying to be an artist, be a performance poet, be in bands, and never. I mean, I was doing it, but never made any money, you know. And only anyone who ever made any money was teaching or whatever. And then along come all these comics going, I don't know, that's my job. I'm a comedian. I earn a living, and sort of the scales fell off my eyes, really. So I hadn't really had a desire to be. I certainly didn't grow up wanting to be a comedian. I'm not even sure if I want to be a comedian now, to be honest with you. But I just. I like writing. I mean, I say that slightly facetiously, Amy, but I also, it's kind of true. I would consider myself, he says loftily, to be a writer. And then, well, firstly, actually, I'd say I was a creative person. And I think it depends, you know, I still do a bit of visual art, a bit of animation, a bit of writing, comedy, and it's kind of, for me, it's almost like, which implement do I pick up? You know, like if it's a paintbrush or it's a pen or it's a computer animation. And but writing jokes and performing them is the one that's made me the money. You know, that's the one that there seems to be, it seems to be, at least for me anyway, the easiest way of making any money. So I've sort of, that's why I do that. But I don't, if I made more money out of, you know, I don't know, being a visual artist, I'd probably do that, to be honest with you.
Is that what you prefer?
I don't know. I mean, no, I mean, don't get me wrong, I do love stand-up and I really like the lifestyle of a stand-up.
Do you?
Well, yes, and sorry, I was going to give you a caveat there, because yes, and it's interesting, although I think it's probably been the ruination of the relationship between my daughter and as mum and myself, because I was always away, and she became what is referred to as a comedy widow of of just comics always been on. And I don't apologise for doing that. That's what I needed to do to make a living as a stand-up. You've got to go where the work is, and the work's all over the place. And I certainly projectedly, you know, now I work kind of all over the world kind of thing. So that aspect of it is excellent. And I love that very much as a lifestyle. That said, I've also really enjoyed 2 years of being in Leon C in my own home, you know, because I haven't had that for 20 years. I've been doing 1,000 miles a week for 20 years, you know, so.
Wow.
I didn't really realise until I'd stopped. I think a lot of comics have said this, that we sort of, once we'd stopped doing that, we sort of realised how insane that kind of lifestyle is, you know, and I've sort of started back into that with...
I've always worked in music with DJs, who obviously they're on the
doing
road
a similar
all the time,
thing, yeah.
And I've just never understood how they do it, really. I mean, obviously the money's good, but just that, I suppose I get it for the beginning, but now, as I'm older, just the thought of travelling that much.
Yeah.
I'm just not that, I like being at home.
Yeah. I do like being home. And I could totally get that. I think I've got a kind of, maybe like a slightly restless soul. And I think I quite like that the journey is the destination sort of.
Yeah.
He says rather wankily, you know, but that kind of, I do, you know, I think I'm quite restless and perhaps slightly itinerant. And I like travelling. I still find, you know, even if I'm going somewhere really kind of, sort of pedestrian, you know, like sort of Rotherham or whatever, I still quite like travelling there, and I've gone to some amazing places that I would never have been to otherwise, you know. I've just come back, I've just been in Norway for whatever it is, a week. I'm going to Dubai in the autumn, and there's loads of stuff, you know. I've been to Pakistan. Who's been to Pakistan, you know? So you sort of, I'm due to go to Iraq again. Who the hell goes to Iraq, you know? Unless you're shooting at people. So I kind of like that, you know. I do, that's I still find that very exciting, although with a peak at, and I can never understand, I was like, but I'm going to Norway, that why on earth would you not find that exciting, you know? People and friends of mine, like, because I like my own home, and maybe there is a, you know, I don't know what if one junior psyched me, whether there's a hollowness inside me that I'm just running away from myself. I'm sure there's an element of that too.
Well, I suppose, because I do think, like, because I have friends and they're just out all the time doing stuff with their kids, like all the time. And I just think, how have you got the energy to get up on a Saturday after you've been working all week and being a parent to then have a whole day out doing something? I'm like, I really look forward to just not having to get up and do loads of stuff. But I envy them in a way, because I do feel like I should do more. Like, don't get me wrong, I'd love to go to Norway.
Yeah, it's
and
tricky.
Go abroad and.
Well, it's tricky when you've got kids younger. You know, I mean, I think it's it's harder. It is harder to do that. I mean, I guess I've been lucky that of a kind of a very understanding well, now ex-partner, she was very supportive at the time. I think she just got sick of it, which I totally understand. And that's not me bad-mouthing her at all. Quite the opposite. I think she was just a bit sick of going out on a Friday night on her own kind of thing, you know, and going to a wedding on her own and all that sort of stuff, which I totally understand. But I don't know, I always loved it. And I was a bit easier when I had kind of, I've just got the one child, so it's a bit easier to kind of put her with a mate of hers or whatever, or a cousin or something, you know, to fit around my schedule. But obviously the logistics of doing that become hard. It is a young men's game. I'm no doubt like DJing as well. It's like, it's better if you're a sort of single young person who can gallivant and take loads of drink and drugs and get off with people and doesn't wherever I lay my hat type thing, you know, that's probably the ideal. But although you can lose.
I think it's just the stamina, isn't it? It's being able to stay up and not sleep. Like now, if I have a night, like when I got the puppy, and there was a few nights where I just didn't really sleep, and that did me. Mm. Like, I think, God, I used to go out and not sleep loads.
I know. Yeah, no, I know.
I'm a bit older now, and I was just like, I don't. But I suppose some people just can't know. They're just used to it, and they enjoy it, and it's not a thing.
Yeah. Well, I try. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, you'll know this yourself. My daughter utterly sort of bollocksed any kind of sleep pattern just for a kind of 5 or 6 years. She was a terrible sleeper. If you tell me your girls are good sleepers, I'll throttle you. But like up yours. I'm furious with this because Clem was terrible, and so on top of my slightly strange sleeping patterns because of the nature of my work, and then she was just a terrible sleeper. It sort of absolutely obliterated any sleep patterns I've got. So now it's kind of, I'm constantly tired and sleep whenever I can kind of thing. So I can sleep, you know, I've got quite into siestas actually.
That's supposed to be really good for you. Yeah. Like mentally as well, that's supposed to be amazing.
That's terrific. Well, I wake really early. I often only get like 5 hours sleep and it's just not enough. But I'm up and I've never been a person who sort of sleeps in. Well done me. I just can't, I'd love to be, can't do it. So I tend to get up but then I've only had 4 or 5 hours sleep. So a siesta, as I say, in my dotage, it's quite good to have a siesta. Perfect.
Well, you live by the sea.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So how did you start with art then? Were you just always extremely creative when you were younger?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's sort of funny. So my father's a vicar. Well, he was a vicar. He died.
Oh, wow.
He died a couple of years ago. And he was also the chaplain of the school I went to for a period. And he taught me RE. And the way he taught RE was we kind of, rather than just sort of banging on about the Gospels, he got us to sort of draw them as kind of cartoons. And I think I just started doing that and enjoyed doing that. And I think it seemed a way of gaining his approval because he was quite an overbearing character. And from that, I just, started to really sort of get a bit of affirmation from, I'm less so now, but I was quite a shy kid and quite wasn't the life and soul, and I think that drawing was a way to get a kind of draw attention to myself and be kind of get affirmation and all of that. And then the school I was at, they had a really good art department, and the art teacher was really great and supportive and really kind of fun, and I just was very much drawn to the art department and the kind of what that, it seemed to be like a kind of port in the storm, really. So it was a private boarding school that I went to, that my father was chaplain, and we lived on the ground. So there was no, and my father was, as I say, rather overbearing, very conservative, sort of God-fearing man. And I think the art department, with its rather fun, liberal teacher, was a sort of safe haven that I kind of enjoyed. I suppose I was quite creative. I mean, I was certainly sensitive. I was a very sensitive young man.
Yeah.
I'm a sensitive old man. So I guess that was...
How many siblings do you have?
Three. I've got an elder... Well, they're all older. Two older sisters and an older brother.
Okay. Was it a mixed school or was it single-sex school?
It was single-sex until sixth form. And then became... Okay. Then all hell broke loose, you know.
Did you sleep in the school or did you sleep at home?
Well, kind of both, actually. Because it was sort of... I mean, officially at home, but kind of, I would often just sort of hang out. Because a lot of if some of the troubled kids would often come down and stay in the chaplain's house, because as a sort of like, you know, he would kind of look up as a sort of pastoral role. They'd pull them out
yes.
of their boarding house and they'd maybe sleep hours or whatever. And my father, they were in a more... like a family environment, I suppose, as opposed to the school institution. And a few of those kids were kind of, because I was a bit of a reprobate, I suppose, they were my friends. So I just sort of would end up, sort of opposite would happen as well, really, where I'd sort of just be in there, like, particularly in the sixth form, we kind of just hang out. And then my father was also in the Navy, so he would go away for periods.
Oh, wow.
So I did. It was sort of, there wasn't really a beginning and an end to my school life. And we were at school 6 days a week. We actually had school. And then my father did chaplain services on the Sunday. So it was pretty much 7 days a week, you know.
Oh my God.
So there was no real let up.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So that's why I'm
saying. A lot of people, I don't know, I just feel like sometimes if you're in that kind of environment, you'll either... completely explode when you get out of it or just I go stick with it, I guess. Did a lot of people kind of I find the whole thing very what's the word?
You don't have to be polite.
I understand why people want their children to have the best education, but for me the idea of sending my children off somewhere, I mean, obviously that wasn't the case with you because you lived there.
No, yeah.
But, I don't know.
I know what you mean. Why have them? I mean, I suppose unless you've got a job that... I mean, my brother was in the Navy. His kids were at boarding school because he was away half the time. So it kind of made sense. But then his wife wasn't. So you sort of... I think I'm not sure... I wouldn't send... Even if I had maybe loads of money, I'm not sure I would send my... daughter to a private school. I think there's a fundamentally a weirdness about it, which I think is what you're sort of alluding to.
Yes.
That it's kind of a bit well, look at the state of the current cabinet. You only have to see what public school does to you, you know.
Yeah.
I think it does. I mean, I'm very grateful for certain things. Like I was really sporty, and the sport aspect of the school was fantastic. As I say.
Yeah.
The art department was incredible. I mean, we had kind of nude life sort of models and all that, you know, all the way,
oh, wow.
I don't think I've ever heard of that normal kind of comprehensive.
I bet they were popular.
Well, I mean, you know, it was kind of, I mean, they, you know, they're not really, because people were a bit sort of baffled by it, but the art, you know, there wasn't anything salacious about that. It was just a really good facility and things were really well, you know, the kind of, The materials that were available to us were probably far further up the food chain than if I'd gone to the local comprehensive school. And going back to my earlier conversation of that being a safe haven, that was a godsend, you know. Huge drawbacks, of course, of where it puts you in relationship to the rest of society, how kind of niche it is and how unlike the rest of society it is. And I think to be sort of, unless you follow in that tradition of just going into the city or the military, which my brother did, I think come out of there kind of a bit high and dry in that sense, because I was pretty keen not to be involved with that kind of person. I wanted to be much more art school, and I think that was kind of a bit of an eye opener. Yeah.
Where did you go to art school?
Well, I went to Edinburgh for a bit, and then probably had, apropos maybe of what we have literally just been talking about, a nervous breakdown. And what I think now is a nervous breakdown. I think at the time, we didn't call it that. I think I was just going, I'd done the head in, and I did a lot of acid, so that I didn't help myself.
Okay,
I think in retrospect, given what we now know about things and the local the current parlance for it all, I just said that was a nervous breakdown. So I left, and then I went to Newcastle. I was in Newcastle. So
it was drawing.
Drawing, printing, painting. Mostly I liked drawing and printing. And I mean, I liked painting in the sense, but I was very influenced by sort of graffiti and kind of like the sort of Keith Haran and Basquiat and people like that, sort of who had also obviously been influenced by graffiti themselves. And a lot of it was pattern and imagery, like graphic imagery and stuff like that, tattoos, etc. I was very influenced by, still am. And so it's kind of, it made for better maybe print work and painting in a way of kind of like you painting, but painting like drawing rather than painting like mixing paints and realism, you know.
When did you start writing?
I think when I was a teenager. I mean, I think that's that sort of always maybe, I think had that sort of, I didn't keep a diary so much, but I kept sketchbooks that were both visual and prose. And I was also very influenced, as I say, at art school by using like prose or the written word as both narrative, like it might say I love you Amy as a definitive sentence, but also as just pattern and image, so like sort of wild style graffiti, you know, like that kind of you didn't necessarily need to read it to kind of go that was a beautiful image, but it might actually say something, so that might communicate. I was always doing that, really, as a kid, and then I've never not stopped that. And I guess I've never kept a diary, as in, you know, July the 18th, I did a Zoom call, except never that literal. But I think, in that, as I say, like just notes. And I've always really liked, so, you know, people sort of go like, oh, they don't like the sound of their own voices. I really like writing. Like, I think my writing is he says so himself, but actually people do say it as well, but it looks really nice, it's very elegant and illegible, but I've always just really enjoyed physically writing. And so it's funny because I haven't now, as I meet comics and they kind of going, yeah, I gotta force myself to sit down and write, and like I've never had that problem, like never. I mean, I'm not saying that it's quality, I mean most of it's crap, you know, but like I don't mean that in a sort of, you know, fishing or like I've sort of my view on creativity is a sort of pyramid thing, that, you know, that it's only the top 5% of it's any use, but the more you write, the bigger the top 5% is. So but I've just always written and enjoyed it, and as I say, never really had a problem with writing and sitting down to write.
How did you sit down and write comedy then? When your friend kind of said, you should do stand-up.
Yeah.
Which, thinking about that gives me anxiety.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I
just
whole 100%.
Of, oh my God, you're well done for doing it, because
But it's...
No.
It's 100%. I suppose... Well, I think, there's two things I'd like to say there. There's a myth that comedians are sort of garrulous and the life and soul of the party, and they if anything, they're the exact opposite of that. Like, people who are garrulous and the life and soul of the party and get up and hold forth and can really hold their own in a social situation don't need to do comedy. You know, they've ticked that box And it's the it's people, and I would put myself in this camp, who are kind of a bit socially awkward or a bit shy or a bit kind of anxious, who sort of look at those people going, well, I'm funnier than that, or I'm more interesting than that, but I haven't got quite the courage to. So a lot of comic people as human beings are socially, like, really awkward and bent out of shape. And I think that's what makes, you know, I don't want to over-romanticise that. I mean, you know, that's the sort of comic equivalent of the Van Gogh suffering and to be an artist kind of thing. And I think too much is made of that. But I think there is a sort of Tears of a Clown, a little bit. I don't know, I wouldn't say that sort of like you need to be a depressive to be a comic, but I do think there's a lot of very socially awkward people who are comics. And that notion that we don't find it frightening is like, no. I mean, like, you'd have to be insane to not find stand-up frightening. It's frightening. But in the same way, are people, you get addicted to it. You know, people get it. Same way that, like, if you can do a bungee jump or jump out of an aeroplane and you're not frightened, you should stop doing it. Because you should, shouldn't you? Because that's when you stop sort of, like, packing your parachute properly or doing all your safety checks on your... But you need to be a bit frightened of it. I mean, I've got obviously, I've got used to doing that and containing the nerves or the fear aspect of it, and certain aspects make me more or less anxious depending on what I'm doing, but I'm probably addicted to that, you know, that slight rush and of the fear. But so, and certainly when I started, you know, I did hope that every time I went to a gig, I hoped that it kind of burnt down so that I didn't have to do the gig, you know. I once bottled out of doing a gig, like only once, when I sort of got there and saw it, and it was like such carnage that I was like, I'm not doing this. But apart from that, you know, I've always done the gig, but kind of, as I say, always hoped that I would get there and I wouldn't have to do it, you know. And
oh,
I still,
really?
Yeah. I mean, like, even yesterday, I was doing a gig, and it was like an outside pub, and it was in Essex, Stow Mary's. Do you know where that is? It's sort of like...
No.
It's not very far away. It's just sort of Chelmsford. It's a really nice pub, but it's a bit Essex. And it was outside, and the audience was sort of everywhere, and a lot of them were sort of... There was a sort of beer garden. There wasn't really a differentiation between where the beer garden ended and the gig started, really, because it was so sort of hot. That everything was so they were kind of chatting, and I just come back from Newcastle, and I was like, I do not want to do this gig, you know. I was like, this is, and I was chatting to the other comic who was on after me, and we were doing Edinburgh previews, and I was like, no, I don't want to. Both of us was like, I don't want to do this. This looks terrible and frightening.
Yeah, yeah.
And we was kind of like, oh, you know, well, I was just in for a penny, and it was fine. But my initial reaction was terror. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
It's all right. Hello.
Hello. What are you saying? Can you have a bath? Yes, you can have a bath.
That's a good idea.
Oh, you smell. You need to have a bath. Okay. Can you go away now, please? Love you. Is Ellie all right?
She's sleeping.
Okay. They always have to. I mean, it's fine. They just have to come and have a look.
Just to come in.
That's just say, what are you doing?
What are you doing?
Moan at me because I'm not giving them enough attention.
That's it.
I do think when you're creating, there is always that fear of it not being good enough or not being accepted or liked or... Mm. Like, you have to care, don't you? If you, you know, you said, if you stop being scared, then you don't care anymore.
Mm.
So obviously there is that.
Yes, yes.
But I find it interesting that you still feel like that after you've been doing it for so long.
Yeah. Well, maybe my ambitions are higher, I suppose. You know, I think you always sort of constantly reach a bit further, maybe. Or, I mean, you certainly should. Otherwise, I guess you've sort of dead in the water, maybe, and repeating yourself. So there is that. I think the psychology of, or the makeup of anyone creative is both, like a megalomaniac, and then like to be so down on yourself, you know, almost like that. On the one hand, you think you're an absolute god, and a genius, yeah, and people really should pay attention to what I'm saying, the world would be a better place. Yeah. And there's the other side of you, George, which is I'm a piece of shit, I'm useless, I should just kill myself, what was I ever thinking, nobody cares about me, you're full of anxiety. And I think you probably seesaw between the two, you know, and it's a sort of, it's a pain in the neck, but I guess it's a sort of, that's the way it is really.
How would you describe your comedy to someone that didn't know what it was like?
I think it's pretty it's all based on my experience. It's in a way that is like a diary of what happens to me. As an example, this year I've been writing about, so I had a stroke. Did you know that? Had we discussed that?
No.
Right. So I had a stroke last year.
Wow.
I don't wonder if Stacey had told you actually, but and so, I lost half of my eyesight, which is why I'm wearing these sort of slightly tinted glasses, because I'm very light sensitive. And so that's obviously a big thing that happened in my life. So I've been writing jokes and writing material about that, you know, and then previously writing material about my daughter and being a father. And then prior to that, being the son of a preacher man kind of thing. So, yeah, it, you know, it does tend
to
be.
You have a lot of material.
Well, I hope so. But it's very much like sort of this is, it's true, you know, it's true.
Yeah.
Like, and then, I mean, of course, I embellished that. And I don't, it's like, yeah, it's not like everything I say has to be true. But it's like 90% true. Some of my favourite comics talk absolute nonsense. You know, by definition, they made it all
who
up.
Who do you like?
I really like, so I like Tim Vine, Milton Jones,
yes,
the Boosh, you know, Noel Fielding, kind of like, yeah. I like a lot, you know, personally, if I'm to watch it, I really like silly stuff, you know. But it's not the stuff I do. I'm not good at it. I suppose perhaps harking back to art school days of, I wish to express myself, man, and tell my, yeah, and sort of say, this is my opinion on this, or this is what happened to me. And so for me, it doesn't really make sense to just do a joke about headphones, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I said this, because, yeah, I teach quite a lot of comedy as well. I mean, and I always sort of said, you know, I sort of say the sort of thing of like, I'm not really very interested in your joke about biscuits, however technically good it is. And, you know, you can technically craft a joke. So it can be really, really clever. But if it's just a joke about biscuits, nobody's got an opinion about biscuits one way or another. You know, yeah, nobody cares. So, but if you're telling me a story about how your dad threw a packet of biscuits at you when you came out to him, or you made a girl pregnant or became pregnant yourself, you go, that's interesting to me, and that's something that I think makes for very good comedy, because it's a sort of a real life event, and people are therefore invested with a bit of heart to it, you know, and a bit of kind of there's an actual journey, an actual story, and an actual these events actually happened, you know, rather than like. So, yeah, if it's a joke about your dad, it's like there's some, yeah, simpatico or pathos going on, rather than just a clever joke with some words that are cleverly arranged. But that said, I do enjoy a lot of comics who really just, you know, take Noel Fielding as an example, or the Boosh.
Yeah.
You're like, it's, and I would say, I don't mean this in a negative way, but it is rubbish. It's nonsense, yeah, isn't it? You know, it's like nonsense. And that's why it's so beautiful and wonderful. But there's no, you don't come back going, yeah, I really agree with their stance on the climate or Boris Johnson or nuclear arms or whatever it is, you know, because there's none of that. And
can we talk about the stroke?
Sure. Yeah.
What happened?
I had a stroke. Well, I've actually had two strokes. So I had one 10 years ago and then I don't know... well, I think they do know why. Now, I've got a hole in my heart, which I think is causing basically a kind of feedback, and gave me a blood clot. So I think hopefully that's the, I mean, I'm waiting on that being closed. I've got like a heart monitor in my chest that
my friend had. I think she was 35. She had a stroke because she had a hole in her heart, and they've put something in it, or they've closed it or something. Yeah. But she was awake because it was COVID, and they didn't want to give her. They didn't want to knock her out.
Yeah.
Because then she would be in there for longer. Yeah, so she was watching it on the screen.
Oh wow!
And they were putting these. Yeah, it sounds absolutely amazing. But
is she
all
right?
She's
all right.
Yeah. Yeah, she's fine. Touch
wood. That's good. Yeah, it's funny because people tell me that, and I go, "How are they?" And they go, "Oh, dead." And you go, "Thanks for telling me that." So I was just checking.
Oh, no. She's absolutely fine. Yeah, good. She's absolutely
that's
fine.
The story I want to hear. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the first one 10 years ago.
Yeah. So it is more common than you know. It does tend to be older people, but it is a lot more common in younger people and kids than people assume. And so the first one I had it in my sleep, and so I woke up and I couldn't see very well. The second one, it woke me up, and I felt like I was in a kind of, I felt like I was in a tumble dryer with like the biggest pain in my head, and my vision was appalling. And it's affected me. I don't know how it affected your friend, but it's affected my eyesight. Nothing else, yeah. Really. How was she affected?
I don't think she's been affected.
She's been in full recovery.
She has trouble thinking of words and remembering things.
Yeah, I forgot there's a term for that, which I've forgotten, weirdly. But
yeah.
I don't think, I mean, I was terrified that was, you know, because I was, when I went into hospital, I was going to everybody. He's like, am I making sense to you? Because, you know, and people were going, I guess, you know. But I can't, I've lost 50% of my eyesight. And that won't, that's permanent. I mean, given what could have happened to me, I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
But it's obviously, I mean, like I can't drive, I can't cycle, I can't really run because I'm just a bit, I'd run into something basically. So
after you had the first one, they didn't figure out that you had a hole in your heart.
Well, they did.
Oh, they did.
Well, they did. So this is, I mean, now I suppose now probably seems like an error. But so at the time, so this is the thing, and your mate might have told you this as well, is that they can't find an actual link between, like a causal link between holes in the heart and strokes. However, the amount of people who have strokes young and also have holes in their hearts is so high that they're going... Yeah. Like it's time and time again, I have this conversation as to you just said, my mate or me they had a hole in their heart. That like they're going, there must be a correlation.
Yeah.
But we can't find it yet. So but at the time, 10 years ago, it was quite a mild stroke and I was a friend of mine who was a heart surgeon, he was kind of going, well, you would be having, you know, if they said to you this is definitely what caused a stroke, then you go, maybe you should have a heart operation. And back 10 years ago as well, it was a bit more involved than it now is, which is all like keyhole surgery and you're in and out in a day and like your mate that can do it without knocking you out and all this sort of thing. But, you know, obviously going back in the day, that was more and more primitive.
Yeah.
And I just sort of thought, I literally, you know, as I say, foolishly now, I suppose, as it turns out, I thought it was just a sort of absolute blip, one off, and I thought I don't want heart surgery on a maybe, you know. But obviously it's happened again, so this is a revisiting that may have been a foolish thing to do or not do, and now like I have elected to have it done because they're saying like the likelihood of it being a hole in the heart that's caused it, having had two strokes and there's nothing else wrong with you, because there is nothing else wrong with me. They're kind of going that makes it so much more likely to be the thing causing it. So, so I am getting it closed this time. So, but I'm just waiting on it on an NHS
Do you know how
appointment.
Long, roughly?
Well, it's supposed to be September, October. But
okay,
it's
oh,
sort
that's
of,
not too long then.
It's not too long. Well, but bear in mind that I've been waiting for since last June. But
oh fuck, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's a bit of a ball ache, but I kind of
yeah.
I don't know. I'm trying not to think about it too much. I'm trying to keep healthy and sane and all of that. So
yeah. Well, at least they're doing something, yeah. And then it. You know.
Yeah. I've got like a heart monitor in my chest, and that monitors. It's quite cool actually. You put it. You sort of have your phone, and you put it on the heart, and it reads and sends the information to.
Oh, wow.
Whoever it sends it
to. It's amazing, isn't it? It's yeah. absolutely amazing. Yeah. I had palpitations. I think it was. I was taking the pill. I've never been able to take hormones. Mm. And. I was like, I bet it's the pill. Because I was just kept getting like flutters.
Yeah.
And, but my doctor was like, because I stopped taking it, I stopped getting the flutters, but my doctor was like, well, we better check it out. But I literally had to lay on the bed and they just put these things on me. And then she phoned someone and they were like, no, she's all right. And then that was it. I was like, how the fuck? I just don't understand how, because the machine was obviously, I don't know. But it was like, it's amazing what they can figure out.
Yeah. Oh, especially with your heart as well, actually. That was one of the other things as well. When I was kind of... And your mate probably said this as well, that obviously when you have strokes, it's either your head or your heart that's the problem. And they know pretty much... I don't think there's anything they don't know about your heart. And, you know, it's a plumbing job and they can literally replace it. They can replace any bit of it. It is literally a plumbing thing. Whereas your brain, they know, you know, a fraction about your brain, and also operating on it is so much more dangerous and more problematic. So, I was really relieved because I was very anxious that it was a brain tumor and kind of So to find out that it's my heart is a lot more of a relief isn't quite the right word, but you know.
Is it that they put like an umbrella in there and open it up?
Exactly that
yeah. Right.
So the umbrella is like a little tiny cocktail umbrella. It's infused with scar tissue, so that it they open that over the hole, sort of goes on, and then because it's infused with scar tissue, it heals very quickly, and that in theory should close it. Yeah, so it's amazing, and they go through your thigh and all of that, and rather than opening up your chest, you know, because I'd heart problems when I was a kid, and I think you know if they'd discovered it then, you know, and that it was open heart surgery, which of course is like much more of an ordeal to get, even if it was the same procedure of closing a tiny hole, but that, you know, that's. Well, imagine the wound and therefore the recovery of that, and also opening your chest and what that might do in terms of, you know, allowing in kind of infection and whatnot. So I think it's a whole lot more dangerous to do open heart surgery for obvious reasons. So this is, relatively speaking, so they say, a kind of a relatively easy procedure.
How long was the recovery for you?
Still recovering, I would say.
Really?
Yeah.
But you've been able to perform?
Yeah. I mean, I took 3 months off where I didn't do anything.
Yeah.
And then I sort of dipped my toe in the water with the occasional gig. And I've been doing that ever since, really. And I found that really empowering and healing to do that, to talk about it. And I, as I say, I've been talking about it more or less. And I found that really sort of, as I say, kind of healing, and that's been really good. And as I say, when I've got that right, people respond to that well. So I've tried not to overdo it. My partner's been driving me around, God bless her. So I'm taking it easy in that respect, you know, and I sort of introduced, I'm probably not up to full speed in terms of gigging schedule, but more or less. And then I sit down for my gig, so I don't sort of, I used to be quite, I don't know, bombastic or certainly quite energetic on stage, which I'm not. I just basically sit down and talk. But actually, I've that's changed. That's sort of stylistically changed. You know, it's a bit like sort of gone from being a kind of guitar band to being an acoustic, you know, and it's changed my writing, and it's also changed, you know, I've now written for that, with that in mind. So I've sort of written acoustic songs or made acoustic versions of the full electric guitar stuff I used to have, which has changed it as well, you know. So I've quite enjoyed that. From a kind of artistic, creative point of view, it's been quite an interesting challenge how that's changed things. It's a bit calmer, you know. And so, yeah, I found all of that very empowering, really. To get back on the horse, as it were, you know.
Yeah, well, thank God you can.
Yeah.
And fingers crossed you'll have your surgery soon. And
yeah, no, I hope so. Exactly. You don't have to worry about it. Exactly. And it's, I hope that's me done, really. And I'll stagger through life with half my eyesight, but I'll take that given what could have happened to me. And,
well, yeah. I mean, I know it's shit, but I suppose that's the only thing you can just think. Well, at least because it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
My dad could've had a mini stroke?
Yeah, like a TIA, was it?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. God, Lola was a baby. She's 11 now. But he, ever since, it knocked his confidence, and it's finding the words. And he was very much a talker, like that's all. He talked about politics, about everything, constantly. But since then, he kind of sits back now and listens, which is hard because he's deaf. or at least he is when my mum's having a go at him.
Yeah, but, right. He's selectively deaf.
Yes, but yeah, that's. But then he's getting older. You don't know how much of it is the stroke and how much
because
it happened after he retired, and I think that's quite common.
Can do, can't it? You bit off the bits can start to fall off when people slow down. I mean, there is that. I mean, I suppose I think if it happened to me in my 20s when I was really athletic and really sort of liked to gallivant around, but, you know, I was doing less of that nowadays, so its impact is less physically. Mentally, I mean, I think that has made me a lot more anxious. I mean, I was quite anxious. Yeah. I've always been quite anxious, but it certainly, that's quite a well-known post-stroke scenario to sort of suffer anxiety and depression. I mean, it probably is from anything fairly major, but, you know, because you realise your mortality and all of this sort of, you know, you're not the invincible, particularly from, I don't know, maybe not particularly for a man, maybe that's nonsense, but like, but I always felt, as I say, I was very sporty and I always felt sort of physically indomitable, and it's like, and now, and I feel a little bit like a kind of frail old man, you know, and no doubt part of that is at just age, you know, but it is also like, I am a bit kind of like, and people, you know, I can't see anything until it comes here, and then people, I'm a bit like, hey, like that. So I'm a bit more anxious about, certainly more anxious about my body. And I'm not really fit either, because until my heart is closed, I'm sort of not doing any kind of exercise, which I'm kind of limited to do. I've just started climbing, actually, which has been really good.
Oh, wow.
Because I can, you know, like anything moving, like cycling or running, I just can't do. But climbing, because I, you know, it's kind of all right. Things aren't moving very fast, and I can't. Yeah, you know, I can just sort of slightly look like that. So that's been brilliant. And yoga,
really hard climbing.
Well, they've just opened that. There's a big indoor climbing wall in Southend that they just opened. It's a really nice. Have you ever been climbing?
My daughter for her birthday. There's a place in Lakeside. It's not like a climbing wall. Well, no, there are some bits of climbing wall, but I just went basically it was a ladder.
Yeah.
But I literally went, probably my feet were where the top of my head would be. I'm 5'3".
Yeah.
And I just was like, I cannot. I managed to get myself back down, but it completely freaked me out. Heights, I just can't.
Can't do it.
I can't.
Maybe climbing's not for you.
It's embarrassing.
Climbing's not for you.
I was with a load of 11-year-olds. One of them was just straight up.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, God.
Not for you.
No.
Not for you.
But I just physically, there's a place where we walk the dogs, funnily enough, an outdoor place, Lee Valley, I think, is it?
Yeah.
And they've got these whole big bouldery things that people climb on, and you just stand and watch them, because I just knowing the physical strength that it takes to kind of do that and then get round the corners.
Some people are unbelievably good. I mean, I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm not, but I'm enjoying that, and it's a nice. Well, it's nice to be able to do a sport that I can do.
Exactly.
And,
I think I'd love to be able to do it because I think it's
a good. I'm quite sort of rangy, I suppose. I'm quite and I do a lot of yoga, and so it plays into my core, I suppose.
It's great that you can adapt to different
things. As I said, I've just been swimming in the sea with my partner, and that's really lovely as well.
That's nice.
I can still do that. I kind of, obviously it's not ideal to have a stroke. I mean, the other flip from the flip side, and from an awful kind of cynical comic sort of thing, comics will say that, you know, something terrible happens to you, it's about 0.5 of a second before you think it's to make a good routine. And equally, you know, same with a stroke, you know, you're going to go, oh, there's some material in this, you know.
Yeah.
Which is a horrible admission, but my cynical brain.
It is, but then also you've got to take the positive, haven't you? Not that it is a positive, but do you know what I mean? That's what kind of keeps you going, doesn't it? If you can take something from a situation that you can then build on, then
absolutely, yeah.
You're winning, aren't you?
Yeah, and your weaknesses become your strengths, I suppose, and all of that, all of those sort of glib aphorisms. But it is true. It is true. It's empowering to take that, own that, you know, and
survive it.
Yeah,
I just think we all got through lockdown.
Yeah.
You know, people do get through things. I mean, not that was awful for a lot. Well, it was obviously awful for a lot of people, but for some people, it wasn't that much of a thing. But I just think you just got to kind of look at what you've got through
and find
some comfort.
Of course. No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, you can kind of, I suppose it's interesting, because I was actually sort of thinking about this and trying to write something of kind of, you want to kind of, there is always someone less fortunate than yourself, you know, and you can kind of see that. You only have to kind of see someone in someone in a wheelchair and think, thank God that's not me or whatever, you know, and no judgment on them, obviously, but I'll just kind of go, I'd hate to be in that position. Or even mental health, you know, which is, you know, it's an absolute blight, of course. And you sort of thank your lucky stars. And on that side, that's worth doing, and it really is worth doing to realise that your cup's half full. But I think you also need to acknowledge the impact as well, you know, and that kind of, rather than just, I think that's something that I've struggled with and I'm trying to take on board, because I certainly come from that kind of pull your socks up, stiff upper lip, suck it up, soft cock kind of aspect, you know, and I think that's damaging too, you know, to not acknowledge that you have issues, that you have weaknesses, that you have things that you need help with, that you have stuff that you struggle with, be they physical or mental or whatever. So it's kind of quite nice to sort of, you know, I'm trying to kind of work that my way through that, really, you know, because constantly kind of people would say, oh, you know, you don't look like, you look really well, you don't look like as you've had a stroke, and I kind of go, And I always sort of go, well, I've lost half my sight, but I can still see out the other half. And I'm always sort of trying to be positive in that sort of situation, which is good. But you're sort of, it's good to go. It's good to say, but I can see the other half, you know. But it's also, I need to acknowledge that I can't see the other half, you know. I not just sweep it under the carpet. And that's sort of, kind of where I'm at the moment, really. Of trying to kind of process that.
Because I always try and think, okay, well, this, at least it's not as bad as this, or try and think of the worst case scenario or whatever, but equally it's very important to acknowledge the fact that something really shit has happened, and you know, but is that a fine balance? I think I don't know if it's a survival thing, whereas you have to just keep thinking it's going to be all right, you know, because you're worried if you don't, then...
Yeah, of course, exactly.
You know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
Well, thank you very much. much for coming to talk to me about it.
You're welcome. I'm sorry that it took rather... Oh, well, I suppose it wasn't betwixt and between us. There was it took longer than it should have done to get here.
That's life.
We got here in the end.
Was Oslo lovely? Did you have a lovely time in Norway?
Do you know what? We had an exceptionally beautiful time. I mean, I've been to Oslo quite a lot, and I've got really good friends there. And it was beautiful weather, and we were swimming in the fjord, and it was just fucking. I was with like one of the other comics is a very good friend of mine who was going. My partner came out for about 4 days of it because I was there for about just over a week, and so it's gorgeous, but it's so expensive. That it's kind of, have you been?
Yes, I have been.
Yeah, well then you know, and it's kind of prohibitively, it's gorgeous. But we were trying to do everything that was kind of free, like swimming in the sea and going for walks in the hills. And you know, the weather was amazing, so we were able to do that. But you know, in terms of sort of like city breaks or whatever, you know, you really can't even afford to kind of have a glass of wine or a meal out, really. You know, so we were doing that kind of breakfast. Eating as much as we could and then snaffling a sandwich in our bags at breakfast and then trying to survive on that, you know, because it's...
I think we went, it was before children, maybe 2008, and we worked out it was about £5 of our money was about £1 of their money.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's got worse.
No, that's about right, yeah, but it is...
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't... Your money doesn't go very far, does it? And you're kind of going, I don't mind paying over the odds a little bit because you're on holiday... But you get to a point where you just go, I don't know if I want to spend £40 on a pizza. I just don't. You know what I mean? I'd rather go without and have the best pizza in my life when I get home, and it would still be only 20 quid. Yeah. You know, like I'm sure you're exactly the same. It's like All right, I'll spend 25 quid on a pizza. That's all right. I'll just suck it up. But this is just like going, I can't enjoy that. You know.
Yeah.
So it's sort of I mean, we're lucky we're working, and then they tend to feed us occasionally, and they certainly give us drinks and stuff like that. So that's all right. But usually I would go, if I was doing any other place on the planet, really, you'd go out with the comics afterwards and go out drinking, and it's a good way of kind of socializing and just seeing the city and whatnot. And you just can't afford, it's just pointless to go there and just spend all of your money.
Yeah.
Afterwards, you may, well, I was not going there on a vanity or holiday. I'm working, so I need to earn money. Yeah. You know, the flip side, I suppose, is that you earn quite good money because they do pay you decently. You know, because of what would seem like a perfectly normal payday for them, for us is like good. So there's sort of swings and roundabouts. So I had a lovely time, and the weather was great.
It is beautiful.
It is beautiful.
It's beautiful. Yeah, it's
beautiful. Did you?
I went. I partied. It was friends that we'd made at a festival.
Yeah.
And who, they're all like Vikings. They're all like 6 foot.
Yeah. Everyone looks so Norwegian, don't they? Norwegians look so Norwegian.
And we just went and we basically partied for a week.
Nice.
I've never taken so many drugs in my entire life. And that's the drugs were ridiculously expensive.
I bet they were.
But, and we didn't sleep and it didn't get dark.
Yeah, well, that's the interesting thing, isn't it?
Because it's... Yeah, so you'd be like 2 o'clock in the morning. You think, oh, it's a nice pink sky, and you'd be like, fucking hell, it's 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And we're still,
it's crazy. Yeah. I love that. I mean, that sort of mercurial light is gorgeous.
It is beautiful. It did feel strange. It was nice to experience it, but it's very strange when it doesn't get dark. But equally, I would really not like to experience it the other way.
Yeah. Yeah,
I really wouldn't. That would.
Yeah, no, it's
I
all.
Don't like
I mean,
that.
I've been there in December, and it's kind of, as you say, it sort of gets light at 11, and there's dark again at 3, and that's pretty miserable.
Yeah.
That's pretty miserable. But so that's we definitely picked the right time of year to go.
Definitely, we went the same. It was like July time.
Yeah.
But it is just the most beautiful place. I've got pictures in my bathroom of pictures that I took in Norway and Sri Lanka. Because I think they're both like the most beautiful places I've ever.
I haven't been to Sri Lanka.
Yeah, it's just gorgeous.
Yeah, right.
But it's definitely worth a visit. But just
save up. Yes. Yeah. Indeed. Right.
Well, thank you so much, and good luck with the operation. I'll keep everything crossed. It happens sooner.
Thank you so much.
Later.
Thank you.
And I will share everything.
Yes, of course, of course, of course. I'll send this through to you. Shall I stop it now?
Hi. So, yes, that was the lovely Marcus. If you want to get in touch and talk about anything that we discuss, then please do. You can find me at Mum and Mama Pod on all the socials, or mumandmamapod@gmail.com. Or if you have any guest suggestions, please subscribe to the podcast and share the podcast. I appreciate it. If this is your first time, then I've got loads of lovely chats with loads of lovely people. So please make sure you check out the back catalogue. And I look forward to seeing you again next week when I have a very special episode with someone who used to live in a squat and rave all the time. I never really knew anything. Well, I obviously knew about that world, but I've never spoken to anyone about
work.
Living in a squat and partying all the time. But yeah, it's
work.
Yeah, that was a good chat. So yeah, I look forward to that work. One. But I hope you're good, and I'll see you next week. Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.